Hello, everyone. I'm Martin R. Schneider, co-host of Political Theater. Before you listen to this episode, I wanted to preface it with some statements, because a lot of things have happened between when we recorded it and now with you listening to it. These are corrections, amendments, things that I noticed while we were editing, and a lot of it's in response to events that have happened since we produced this. The episode you're about to hear is about journalism, the responsibilities of journalists, the importance of journalistic integrity, and the role that journalism plays in U.S. politics, particularly elections. We also talk a lot about the importance of media literacy and how to determine a valid source of information from a made-up one. In doing this, we do use examples from traditionally respected sources like the New York Times and the Washington Post. This should not be seen as a tacit endorsement of those agencies, however. Irresponsible journalism can happen at any level, and stories and sources should be evaluated as they come. One thing to keep in mind is that individual journalists rarely, if ever, write their own headlines or decide their own printing schedule or article placement. Those decisions are left to the editorial boards of each publisher. So if something seems strange about an information source, see who the editors are, and more importantly, who the owners are. If you want to see some examples of modern journalistic integrity from the past few months, you should look at Teen Vogue magazine, specifically the journalist Lauren Duca and the editor-in-chief Elaine Welteroth. But more importantly, in this episode, you're going to hear us use the phrase fake news a lot. And that phrase has been co-opted and has come to mean something completely different than it did when we recorded this. The fake news that we mentioned in this episode refers to exactly that. Completely fabricated pieces, or tweets, that are passing themselves off as fact. You'll hear us refer to Macedonian teenagers a lot as a source of this, because evidence has shown this to be true. The tweets and the stories and the lies that we've referred to as fake news in this episode are actually propaganda, and that's the terminology we really should have been using all along. Refusing to call it by its proper term is a complete oversight on our part, and it only serves to contribute to its power. But recently, fake news has come to mean news which comes from a source that I personally dislike, and everyone from your racist cousin on Facebook to Donald Trump himself have used it this way to discredit media. The term fake news is now used to immediately dismiss any reporting or factual information that a person does not like or disagrees with. And that version of fake news is much more dangerous and a much more potent threat to democracy than any of the made-up stories you'll hear us discuss in this episode. Marta and I recorded this episode because we believe in the importance of a free and independent press, and we also believe those institutions are under threat. So in order to save it, it's important to understand what it actually entails, both positive and negative. That's the only way to arm yourself with the critical thinking ability and the media knowledge necessary to survive the current political climate. So with that in mind, please enjoy this episode of Political Theater.
What is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, what you can taste and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain. This is the world that you know.
So the reason we are bringing up the question of reality is because we just had a presidential election. And it wasn't just any presidential election.
It became harder to tell what the facts were from the fiction, and more so than normal elections. We live at a time where all of our news sources are partially entertainment, which means that they're partially fictionalized. So we're hearing a lot about fake news and news misdeception. Misdeception is not a word.
But it could be.
We're hearing a lot about news deception and fake news. So the question really becomes, at a time when all news is a little bit fake, how do you tell what's real fake from fake fake? That's what we're talking about here today on Political Theater, and particularly
how it's related to the 2016 U.S. election. I think we all got to a point, especially during the campaign, where we would see so many mistruths and obvious blatant lies just be accepted as fact or tossed aside, especially during the debates, and they went unchallenged, that it wouldn't be a surprise to us if our debates sounded like this.
I'm an American. And I believe in American ingenuity and hard work, unlike my friend here, Cam Brady, who believes that everyone should live in rainbow land.
Douglas, I'd like to say one thing. I'm an American, too. And I have no idea what he's referring to as rainbow land, okay?
I'm referring to a 13-page doctrine written by Camden Brady called Rainbow Land.
That's something I wrote in the second grade.
I think anybody that writes about the redistribution of wealth sounds like a communist to me. Am I right?
Hold on. It is the simple story of a teddy bear giving a pot of gold to a leprechaun, okay?
Right. May I read from page 7? Please come with me to Rainbow Land, where unicorns are made of fudge and cotton candy, and everything is free.
It's a fictitious place. Rainbow Land is fiction.
I guess we're all idiots, according to Cam Brady.
I didn't say that. I did not say that.
So that was a clip from the campaign with Will Ferrell and Zach Galifianakis playing opposing presidential candidates. Marty, you love this movie.
I love this movie so much because Will Ferrell based a lot of his performance off of John Edwards, who was John Kerry's vice presidential candidate. And it's kind of funny when if you ever put the two clips side by side of, you know, John Edwards in 2004 and Will Ferrell in this movie. But what's also amazing about the scene that we just listened to is it plays perfectly to the stereotypes that are associated with being too liberal or being too conservative.
So the campaign works so well as a satire because it falls under a "it's funny because it's true" kind of situation.
It's funny because it's true.
It's funny because it's true situation. But it also plays to these stereotypes that we all know. And that kind of works with our greater point, which is basically when you don't know that much about something, for example, journalism, how that, or a campaign, when you don't have personal firsthand knowledge of how that actually works, you are inclined to go off perceptions that you've taken from the media, taken from pop culture. And that inspired our title for today. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Rainbow Land. So we need to back up a little bit here, I think, to talk about just why this is important.
Lay it on me, Marty.
All right. Journalism and the press are often referred to as the fourth estate. The term hails from British Parliament, so to put it in an American context, if there are three branches of government,
executive, judicial, legislative,
then the press represents the fourth arm of government. And in a way, it kind of is, because the press and the media are responsible for keeping an informed electorate. They're the ones who are supposed to present the information to the masses. And if they can't do that, or if they do it poorly, or if they do it in a biased way, then democracy itself kind of falls apart.
But how did this breakdown come about? Donald Trump's campaign didn't invent distrust in the media, but it sure as hell exploited it.
We've been hearing a lot of talk about how fake news may have influenced this election. However, there's so many sources of news, and everyone by this point has chosen their own...
They live in their own bubble. They've chosen their own... It's like a pick-your-own-adventure except for your political affiliation.
Right, and we've shown that your news aggregate sources, most people get their news from social media, things like Facebook and Twitter, which run off of algorithms to show you things that you like or things that you're already predisposed to want to share.
Like, I like chocolate, or I like cats, or I like kung fu movies.
Exactly.
And it'll show you all, like, chocolate, kung fu, cats, or kung fu movies.
Or even more just, like, my friends all seem to enjoy kung fu movies and cats, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm in the demographic to want to like that and share it. And as a result, when you bring in your political affiliations to this, you wind up just getting information that's tailored to you to already enjoy and want to share, whether that information is real or not.
Mm-hmm. And like you were saying before we got on today, it's a very Aaron Sorkinized version of politics. If you didn't like the ending that you got before, you can escape into a version of reality that better suits your need and get your comfort that way.
Right. And this is something that happens bipartisan. This is something that both sides do. We all like to mix our news with our entertainment. We like to mix our sports with our entertainment. There's nothing inherently wrong with this. But the problem happens when it becomes impossible to tell our fact from our fiction, our reality from our quote-unquote, air quotes, reality. Especially when the president-elect is a reality television star who is very, very good at manipulating the news and the media.
Mm-hmm. But the other problem is people don't read stories anymore. They're looking for headlines. So you were telling me earlier that the New York Times published a headline about Donald Trump's deal with Carrier.
Yeah, the Carrier headline read something along the lines of, Trump visits Indiana, comma, jobs stay in America.
So it sounds like it's saying that thanks to his trip to Indiana, Trump was able to keep 1,000 jobs in America. But you don't get the full story that way, you're only getting the headline.
Those two things are technically true, but there is no evidence that one led to the other. You are assuming that correlation proves causation in that case. Now, when you actually read the article, there's interesting points in there about how this isn't actually the president's job. It posits that if Barack Obama had done this, he would have garnered criticism for interfering in the free market, rightfully. It also mentions that these are promises that the president-elect cannot actually keep. None of that matters.
Right. We don't get that because most of us in our hectic day-to-day lives who have attention spans of 90 seconds or less, we want the headline. We want our news in little compartments, or we want it in a way that makes us laugh.
There's a scene in The Ides of March, 2011 film directed by George Clooney. At the end of The Ides of March is a movie we're going to get into a little bit later, but at the end of it, Ryan Gosling, who was a junior campaign manager, and at this point in the movie, he has, through illicit and somewhat immoral means, kind of ascended to what we're going to call the Steve Bannon role. He has his mouth to the ear of the next president of the United States. And Marissa Tomei plays Ida Horowitz, who is kind of the representation of the news media. She is a New York Times reporter, and she and Gosling have had this rapport together for most of the movie where they kind of laugh and flirt and say, "Are we friends? Come on, I'm your friend. Give me this story." But at the end of the movie, the very last bit of dialogue between them is him shutting her out of a press event. And she asks, "Oh, aren't we friends anymore?" And he responds with, "You're my best friend."
Why do you sound like you're from Brooklyn?
That was my Ryan Gosling impression.
"You're my best friend." You sound like you're from Brooklyn.
Well, my other Ryan Gosling impression is just staring sadly at nothing. And that doesn't really play in an audio format, Marta.
This is true.
That scene is crucial because of who those characters represent. They represent the media estate versus the person, the power behind the throne. And what happens next is he walks into a gym and he's about to give an interview. And there's a long close-up of the seat that he's actually about to sit in. And it is a director's chair, which in movie terms means this is the person in charge and that's where he sits. That scene, I think, is how a lot of people perceive the relationship between media and government. Like, we are friends as long as you stay in your lane and do what I tell you to.
Like, it's like an orchestra. One is clearly playing the other.
And maybe that's deserved, maybe that's not. To tie it into real life, President-elect Donald Trump did have an off-the-record meeting with the heads of all of the major news corporations. Television, CNN, Fox News, etc. They were on a completely off-the-record meeting. We don't know what happened in that. The New York Times also had an off-the-record meeting with President-elect Trump, but they also had a mostly on-the-record meeting afterwards that we do have the transcript of, except for the part about Syria. That part went off the record. So it's more illustrations of distrust, of the idea that our media institution is inherently flawed. Is it deserved? Maybe.
To get a better idea of what makes fake news and what makes a legitimate news source, and what does a healthy relationship between the government and the press look like, I decided to have a conversation with a friend. My friend, Steven Siegel, former editor of the Philadelphia Weekly.
I don't think there's a single right answer to what a journalistic relationship with government looks like over time. But that said, you know, a healthy relationship is an independent one, and a healthy relationship is an honest one. Journalistic entities shouldn't be beholden to the government or to any other entity that they're reporting on. You know, they should be beholden to the public interest. There's a reason why we don't just sit back and let government communications departments give us all our information. And part of the reason there is that journalism only works if people trust who's talking to them. If they think the media and the government and the corporations are all part of a big conspiracy together, then we don't have a base of facts to agree on, even as a starting point for discussion about anything. And once we're living in that kind of fact-challenged environment, it's hard for anybody to ever give anybody else the benefit of the doubt, which makes it pretty close to impossible to have a reasoned debate about anything. It would be very depressing to suggest that that's where we are now.
But it kind of is where we are, and it's where we've been for some time.
But we probably just didn't realize it until now.
It dates all the way back to the 1800s and the yellow journalism style fight between William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer, who tried to outdo each other in sensationalist headlines to the point where it may have inadvertently gotten America involved in the Spanish-American War. Or at the very least, it garnered a lot of attention and public opinion regarding the war. And television, when that came along, changed things immensely.
It was a medium that really emphasized image and appearance over substance.
And the biggest turning point is going to be 1960.
When we had the first televised presidential debate.
Between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon, which Republicans will still tell you to this day won the debate or won the election for Kennedy because he was a young, good-looking man who had a lot of charisma, which Richard Nixon did not.
But plus, Nixon, to his credit, people who listened to the debates on the radio said that Nixon was the clear winner and Kennedy was not. But the problem was Nixon had been sick for a couple of days leading up to that. So he looked haggard, he looked sweaty, he looked a little bit aloof.
How could you tell?
Because if you look at the footage and if
No, I mean just in general. That's how Nixon looked all the time.
Well, no, but if you watch the footage, he's definitely, like, he's got a 5 o'clock shadow. His face is all moist because they didn't put any makeup on him. They're like, oh, he'll be fine. Like, his ideas and his words will speak for him. Whereas Jack Kennedy had his campaign manager ran out and got him foundation at the local drugstore so that his face wouldn't be shiny and he would look composed and youthful. And it worked, even though people who listened to it would say, but Nixon was the winner of this one. Jack Kennedy looked the part. And in our society, even now, you have to look the part for people to get that buy-in from you.
That's a key point you just mentioned. Image is everything. At this point, it's not enough for politicians to be politicians. They need to have image consultants, much the same way someone like Jennifer Lawrence would. Something to build a public persona. And Hillary Clinton, deserved it or not, had a public persona that had made people uncomfortable. Or that others had tried for years to cultivate for her. It was thrust upon her. It's not something she cultivated for herself.
And what was interesting is during the election, somebody wrote an article in their as an update on their Facebook page, which I thought was even more amazing. They wrote an update on their Facebook page that basically talked about the fact that when Hillary is in office, her approval ratings are amazing. But when she's running for office, they're in the toilet because we're comfortable with the idea of somebody actually being in power. But when they're actually trying to get your vote or ask for it, it's a different story.
As Billy Bob Thornton puts it in Primary Colors,
the media giveth and go fuck yourself.
Ho 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 ho! Merry Christmas! Greetings, holiday shoppers. I'm Joseph Wade, and I host a podcast called Christmas Creeps. My band of merry mischief makers and I dissect holiday movies and specials all year round in search of the true meaning of Christmas. So whether you can't resist the urge to watch Home Alone in June, or you worship at the altar of mutant killer snowmen, Christmas Creeps is the podcast for the Grinch in all of us. Check us out at ChristmasCreeps.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Today, Edward George Ruddy was the chairman of the board of the Union Broadcasting Systems, and he died at 11 o'clock this morning of a heart condition, and woe is us. We're in a lot of trouble. So, a rich little man with white hair died. What has that got to do with the price of rice, right? And why is that woe to us? Because you people and 62 million other Americans are listening to me right now. Because less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Because the only truth you know is what you get over this tube. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube is the gospel. The ultimate revelation. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. This tube is the most awesome goddamn force in the whole godless world. And woe is us if it ever falls into the hands of the wrong people. And that's why woe is us that Edward George Ruddy died. Because this company is now in the hands of CCA, the Communication Corporation of America. There's a new chairman of the board, a man called Frank Hackett, sitting in Mr. Ruddy's office on the 20th floor. And when the 12th largest company in the world controls the most awesome goddamn propaganda force in the whole godless world, who knows what shit will be peddled for truth on this network?
So that was a clip from Network. That was Peter Finch playing Howard Beale. The whole movie is basically a closer look at how the news is evolving into an entertainment medium instead of a medium that's designed to deliver important information. And that's true even of now. We are turning into one giant BuzzFeed feed.
The reason Network is so interesting to me is I don't think it realizes at the time how relevant it is. So if you haven't seen Network, the premise is that Peter Finch plays a newscaster named Howard Beale, who, after being fired, starts a mental breakdown, and that mental breakdown works its way on the air as he's getting ready to leave. However, his rants and his anger strikes a tone with the public viewing. He's brought back on so that he can be the madman of the airwaves, and he's brought on to have this job so that he can just rant and yell, and it draws a huge audience. And the way that they justify it is they reclassify his news program. It's no longer news. Faye Dunaway's character, who is a young up-and-coming producer, has it switched over to her department, which is
entertainment.
This is the same technicality that is cited by 24-hour news stations like Fox News, for example, where they classify themselves as news entertainment, which means that they don't necessarily even have to report facts. But to give some context to Network,
let's look at the Fairness Doctrine.
If you don't know what the Fairness Doctrine is or was, it was a policy held by the Federal Communications Commission that started in 1949. And basically, it required a couple of things. It meant that if you had a broadcast license, you were obligated to present controversial issues of public importance and to do so in a way that the commission would call equitable and balanced. It's basically the original idea of fair and balanced. It also established the news as a public service that was required if you wanted to broadcast.
and it had to be devoted to a controversial topic or a topic in the public interest.
And it had to present all sides of that flatly and without bias. And this stood for quite a while. We're going to talk about Edward R. Murrow, who was working under the Fairness Doctrine. But at the time of that network was made, there was more of a push to make money off of the news. We're not going to talk about the movie Truth, because both of us didn't like it.
Nope.
But Dan Rather / Robert Redford has a monologue in that where he talks about news making a profit and no longer being for the public good, and that becoming the deterioration. So network comes at a time when the Fairness Doctrine is under question. It's eventually going to be weakened, gutted. And then it's going to be gutted, right? And then eventually repealed. And in network, they reclassify the show as entertainment, which means they don't have to abide by the Fairness Doctrine. So now we have this expectation that there's a little bit of fakeness in our news, which also lets us expect that there's fakeness in our public figures.
So it goes back to the original question. What is real? And how do you know fake news from the real deal? Former editor of Philadelphia Weekly, Stephen H. Siegel.
A reputable news source is a source that is doing actual reporting. That means going to primary sources to gather facts. You know, if a reporter is on the scene interacting with the people who are doing a thing or the people who have witnessed a thing, their story will reflect the fact that they're gathering information firsthand. You'll see quotations from people who are involved. You'll see descriptions of what happened that are cited as eyewitness accounts. What we increasingly see with these, you know, these fake news sites, these clickbait farms online that look like news entities, is that they're basically taking reporting that someone else has already done and they're rewriting it secondhand to focus as much as possible on the most sensational bits of the story and not adding any independent facts, not conducting any independent verification of the facts.
I guess I just don't understand, how hard could it be to spot the fake news from the real news? Because you have nonpartisan organizations, or I'm sorry, news organizations like the New York Times, the Washington Post. And as Stephen says, you look at the organizations that are talking directly to the source. You don't look at, according to the New York Times website, Hillary said this, or according to the Washington Post, Donald Trump was reported to say this. Like, did they go to the actual source or didn't they? Isn't it easy?
There's a couple of answers to your question, Marta. Number one, that you say this, but you have a little bit of media intelligence.
Right.
Like, for you and I, it's a little easier. This isn't something that's taught in schools. Like, you're not taught how to identify a source in elementary or junior high, maybe in high school if you have a good teacher, but especially not in underfunded schools. You're not taught that. Number two, these are articles that appeal to people, and as we've talked about, and everyone does this on both sides of the political spectrum, if something makes you feel good and it confirms what you already believed, you're more likely to share it without thinking about it too hard. If you don't think about it too hard, if you're just like clicking through your Facebook profile throughout the day and you're not a political news junkie like you and I are, they look official. They look official enough that you'll just share it. And the final point is the things that you just listed, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all of these American institutions are things that middle America has been saying has a liberal bias for years. This is distrust that is years old. So there are groups of people who think that the only news source that is fair and balanced is the one that claims to be fair and balanced, Fox News. And even they weren't right-wing enough, we saw sometimes during this past election campaign.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me a lot of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where Zaphod, well, I guess it's not in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but it's in one of the future books where he's shown what the universe would look like if it revolved around him completely. And instead of driving him mad, he's like, oh yeah, I totally knew this already. We're kind of like our own versions of Douglas Adams' universe.
Although, to be fair, you mentioned the BuzzFeedification. Some of the best long-form journalism of the past 5 years has come out of BuzzFeed, because they're the only ones who have the money to assign a reporter to cover something for several months at a time. They're doing good work. Why? Because they have the money to back it up. We mentioned John Oliver. John Oliver doesn't have to worry about sponsors, and he's allowed to dedicate 22 minutes to one issue, going into it deeply. And why does that happen? Because we pay a premium for HBO. As a result, he's outdoing his old bosses at The Daily Show, who still have to answer to Viacom. So it comes back to this idea that reporting the news is noble, but profiting off reporting the news is not. But the two of them have to exist hand in hand. I think about Charles Foster Kane, Citizen Kane. There's that, remember, he's not a journalist, but he owns a newspaper empire because he was based off of
William Randolph Hearst.
Thank you. He's based off of William Randolph Hearst. And there's that shot of him standing on all of the newspapers looking up on the foundation he's built his empire on. Side note, you know how sometimes Turner Classic Movies has celebrities come on and say their favorite movies and they get to host for a night?
Right.
Well, about 10 years ago, I was watching Turner Classic Movies, and the celebrity guest host that night was Donald Trump. And he picked as his favorite movie Citizen Kane. And I have never in my life seen somebody miss the point of a movie so completely and entirely. I was stunned, and I'm more stunned today.
Well, again, though, if you never had much experience in something, where do you go to get that information? You turn to pop culture and movies.
That's right. And for Donald Trump, Citizen Kane's the story of a man who gets everything that he wants. Maybe he misses that last little bit at the end. I don't know.
Maybe if we send him copies of The American President and Dave, maybe he'll get the right idea.
Maybe if we have Alec Baldwin read the press briefings on SNL, he'll actually watch them.
He'll take it in.
He'll start to see our security issues.
Yeah, he can't go to security briefings, but he always has time to watch Saturday Night Live.
I want to talk about this notion that maybe the press is irrelevant. According to President-elect Trump, now that he has this platform, Twitter, he can address people directly. He doesn't have to go through the press. And he said before on Twitter that if the press were covering him more, quote unquote, fairly and honestly, then maybe he wouldn't have to tweet so much, which is just a bizarre statement to say. But he's also not wrong. He's got a direct line, and he hasn't held a press conference in over 6 months, which is strange. Basically, the press now plays defense constantly. He's allowed to say whatever he feels like on Twitter. He can say, I saved 1,100 jobs in Indiana. Boeing has us for a $4 billion Air Force One deal. And once he says that, we have to report on it.
Mm-hmm.
You're scrambling at that point to find out the truth of it.
Like, how much of this is actual news and actual truth, and how much of this is hot air being blown at us?
And by the time it actually settles that the Boeing deal is only $11 million or we're not actually saving 1,100 jobs, by the time that actually settles, it doesn't matter because it's been repeated.
We've moved on to the next headline. And that's the other thing is nobody reads stories anymore. They're only concerned with the headlines, and that's what gets shared on their Facebook page.
The advantage is that we can also look directly at reporters. Donald Trump can go straight to us through the press or with bypassing the press, but the press can also talk to people directly. So when you find reporters that you think are doing good work, that are going to the sources, that are being responsible, you can follow them and you can come up with lists of your own. And maybe we'll do that. Like, we'll probably make like a Twitter list of reporters that we think are doing good work at different organizations. But that requires work. It requires effort. You have to really think about who you trust. And most people don't want to do that.
Yeah, you want to condense your life into 140 characters or less.
You don't care too much to get a bunch of different news sources. You'll take what comes at you from your paper that you believe or what's shared on your Facebook feed. And I don't trust the idea of Facebook determining what is real news and what is fake news either. Because at the end of the day, they are also a corporation and they have their own interests to protect.
So it is really hard to determine nowadays what is real and what is not.
Because everything is a little bit fake.
Uncovering corruption is an important part of the work. It might be the most important part of the work. But in terms of the statistics of what there is to cover day to day, there is less corruption than there is groups of people in government trying to do the job correctly. I saw reporters who certainly didn't take for granted that what they were being told was the whole story, but who also didn't start from the premise that they were being manipulated.
I really like Stephen's optimism there.
Yeah.
It sort of flies in what I've always imagined journalists to be based on their portrayals, where I've always imagined them to be more cynical, more hardened, a little bit jaded about the world. A lot of them are presented as borderline nihilists.
Mm-hmm. They drink a lot, they smoke, they don't sleep very much.
Absolutely. And because they're committed to this idea of public service, that what they're doing is important, so they kind of take on the burdens of the world. At least that's how newspaper journalists are portrayed mm-hmm. most of the time.
Compare that with television news broadcasters.
Right. Other than Edward R. Murrow and the movie Truth, which neither of us liked.
No.
Newspaper journalists are typically portrayed as the heroes.
I mean, hell, Superman was portrayed as a news guy and his alter ego.
Yeah, Superman is a journalist, and that's not unintentional. That wasn't random. That was chosen because journalism was at one point in time seen as an altruistic profession. At least print journalism was. We see television news as sensationalist. Borderline sociopathic, especially run by sociopaths. Network is a good example. Another example is Nightcrawler with Rene Russo and Jake Gyllenhaal, where Gyllenhaal plays a complete sociopath who has no feelings or empathy for human beings whatsoever, and that makes him a great live videographer for an LA news station. And I find that really interesting because it's an illustration of us being aware as an audience that the people we're looking at, the people that are giving us our information, are not the heroes.
Mm-hmm. And it's something you just made me think of. There's a great scene in Spotlight, which came out very recently, that looked at the Boston Globe's coverage of the clergy sex abuse scandal in Boston. The publisher, played by Liev Schreiber, meets with the Archbishop of the Archdiocese of Boston, and the Archbishop tells him, you know, I think it's really great when the Globe and the Church work closely together. And without missing a beat, the publisher says, actually, I think that they work more efficiently when they're not working together. And that's the thing. If you have, and even Stephen mentions that in the interview, if they're working too closely together, it kind of blurs the line of, are we doing right by our sources? Are we getting accurate information? Or are we just the mouthpiece of the government?
Journalism is such a strange, it's in such a strange, damned if you do, damned if you don't position.
Right. That no one's willing to pay for. Everybody wants to get their news for free, and they're not willing to do like HBO or pay for the New York Times. They're like, oh, but this is free and it's clickbait and stuff like that.
So it's not that I think there should be more movies praising the press, but I do think that if there was more films like Spotlight, which shows responsible journalism. And even Spotlight has scenes where Michael Keaton's character realizes that he accidentally, or maybe even on purpose, killed the story that they're working on 5 years ago. If there was more films like that to build trust in the media, things that make Stephen's point that there are more people in this job that want to do it correctly than there are that don't. Maybe it's deserved, maybe it's not. But it would at least do a little bit towards building up media literacy, which we desperately need.
On the other hand, you can't deny that sometimes the media pays a little too much attention to the sensationalist stories. And it's those sensationalist spins that may have had a pretty significant influence on the outcome of the recent 2016 election. It is really hard to determine nowadays what is real and what is not.
Because everything is a little bit fake. And speaking of things that are just a little bit fake, let's talk about
primary colors.
Let's talk about the walking lie.
Primary colors is a thinly veiled parody or a reinterpretation, whatever you will, of the Clintons running for Bill's first presidential campaign in the 1990s.
based on a book written by a journalist. Originally, it was published anonymously, but now it's come out that it was Joe Klein. John Travolta and Emma Thompson played Jack and Susan Stanton. It's an amazing performance by Travolta, especially, who just likes to wrap himself around those Southern Democrat Arkansas governor vowels.
It's pretty good.
It's a very inspiring bit. You want to root for Stanton, but you also see him as, well, you see him off the record.
Off the cuff.
Off the cuff.
Bill Clinton was a really good off-the-cuff speaker. Stanton is a, you know, a walking lie, but he's able to get people to forgive him time and time again because he's so darn charming and his heart's in the right place.
This is John Travolta playing Bill Clinton in Everything But Name and doing an amazing job of it.
Totally.
You understand the charisma that is coming off of him, but it's that, like, that Southern drawl, Matthew McConaughey sleaze charisma, like, at the same time. You know, he's having affairs all the way throughout. There's an issue where he sleeps with a young girl and possibly impregnates her, which also is a plot point in The Ides of March. Yeah.
Throw a pregnant girl into the mix and drama ensues.
Oh, the women in these movies are treated just like props. I know.
We need more movies with women running as president, but that'll be a fodder for a different episode.
And the only one who really stands on their own is Emma Thompson in Primary Colors.
Oh, God, yes.
Because she's Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Maybe they'll do a secondary Colors movie where it's her trying to run for office.
Oh, I would love that. Secondary Colors is such a good title, too.
What was interesting about this film, though, which was directed by one of my favorite directors, Mike Nichols, who did The Birdcage and The Graduate, the film begins and ends with a handshake. And on top of that handshake is a really great monologue that kind of lays out a promise to you about the main character and what's going to transpire between Jack Stanton, the guy who shakes hands, okay, and Henry Burton, who is the lead character in this movie, who plays the campaign manager of Jack Stanton's campaign.
You know, I've seen him do it a million times now, but I can't tell you how he does it, Henry. The right-handed part. I can tell you a whole lot about what he does with his left hand, though. He's a genius with it. He might put that left hand on your elbow. Or up on your bicep, like he's doing now. Very basic move. He's interested in you. He's honored to meet you. But if he gets any higher, if he gets on your shoulder like that, it's not as intimate. It means he'll share a laugh with you or a secret. A light secret, not a real one, but very flattering. If he doesn't know you that well, he wants to share something emotional with you, he'll lock in with a two-hander. Well, you'll see when he shakes hands with you, Henry. Governor!
So like I said before, the film begins and ends with a handshake, only you find at the end of the movie the two-hander shake is given to Henry. So he's a guy that Stanton doesn't know very well, but he's going to have an emotional experience with him. And we go on that emotional journey throughout the film.
It's a long film, and I'm going to say I think the first 90 minutes are probably more interesting than the latter half of the film. But it's true. It's a journey. And it's a journey of falling in love with this candidate.
Who's a walking lie.
Who is a walking lie, the way they describe him. But we love that lie.
Mm-hmm.
We like that lie. Part of that, I think, is because we feel almost obligated to be lied to at this point.
Yeah.
It's how the game is played. However, in his big speech to the Steelworkers Union?
Yeah, something like that.
To the big speech to the Steelworkers Union, Jack Burton walks out.
Or Jack Stanton.
Jack Stanton. Jack Burton is Kurt Russell in Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah. We'll talk about that in another episode.
We really should talk about that. His big moment, his shining moment of glory, comes at the Steelworkers Union meeting when he says,
I'm going to do something real ridiculous. I'm going to tell the truth.
And I don't have to tell you how hard it is to be looking for work. Hey, I don't have to tell you anything about hard times. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do something really outrageous. I'm going to tell the truth. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking he must really be desperate to do that. But if you had to swallow enough garbage.
You can say shit. We're X-rated.
me too, if you believe what you read in the paper. Okay. All right. Here's the truth. No politician can reopen this factory or bring back the shipyard jobs or make your union strong again. No politician can make it be the way it used to be, because we're living in a new world now, a world without economic borders. A guy can push a button in New York and move $1 billion to Tokyo in the blink of an eye. And in that world, muscle jobs go where muscle labor is cheap, and that is not here.
I do want to say about that clip, it's strange. It's almost become backwards wishful thinking. It's become posthumously wishful thinking. Because, man, do I wish somebody had stood up and said, I can't bring your jobs back to the middle American working class that we think flipped this election.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a lot of thoughts about this movie.
Yeah, I totally do. But one of the ones that's kind of funny and, you know, won't change history, but one of the cameos that you see a couple of times in this movie is Larry Menty. Larry Menty was a news anchor for NBC 10 News, and he was famously fired because he was peeping into one of his coworkers' email accounts and sending the information out to the media. So that was another instance where it was like, there was that relationship that was really questionable, and is this really news, or are we just doing like what the Pope was talking about, where you're taking crap and you're processing crap and sending crap out back into the world? Did you hear about that quote?
Yeah, okay, so let's talk about this, especially because Pope blessing Donald Trump was one of our Macedonian fake news stories.
Right. Well, the Pope basically said this week, it's December 2016 at this point, the Pope was saying that the media has to do a better job of not spreading misinformation. And he basically, there's no actual word for it in English, but he was basically saying that the media is consuming and has like a sexual arousal that comes from consuming poop. So by consuming poop and then filtering poop back out into the world, you're not really spreading knowledge, you're spreading more poop. And it's amazing.
So back to Primary Colors. The reason why we brought this movie in is that it has so much in common with The Ides of March. Mm-hmm. We mentioned the pregnancy subplot. Both of these stories are told from the perspective of the young idealist campaign manager.
Right.
Who has to compromise their morals along the way, and they kind of get sucked in. However...
Well, speaking of eating shit, one theme that comes up often throughout Primary Colors, words like stomach, or do you have the stomach for this, or can you swallow this? And what's really brilliant about Mike Nichols and his direction of this movie is that it all, the idea of having the stomach and being able to swallow and, you know, eating shit, as Pope Francis was saying, comes to a head at the part when they've just gone to visit the family of the girl that Stanton may have gotten pregnant, and they're driving away, and Henry's like, pull over, I need to get out of the car for a second, and
Henry is the campaign manager,
the idealistic campaign manager.
And that's the name I was trying to think of earlier.
And he gets out of his car and just starts puking his guts up. So it really looks at, like, what is real and how much bullshit are you willing to process in order to get your guy to win? And there's a great speech about that later on in the movie when basically Stanton is like, you know, this is what the fight is about. The bullshit stops here, but you have to shovel a lot of it in order to get to that office.
So let's talk about Good Night and Good Luck, another film by George Clooney.
With Good Night and Good Luck, and I have to say, I'm a little bit biased because this is one of my all-time favorite movies. Good Night and Good Luck is a criminally underappreciated movie that gets more relevant with each passing years. And it's because of monologues like this one.
Just once in a while, let us exalt the importance of ideas and information. Let us dream to the extent of saying that on a given Sunday night, the time normally occupied by Ed Sullivan is given over to a clinical survey on the state of American education. And a week or two later, the time normally used by Steve Allen is devoted to a thoroughgoing study of American policy in the Middle East. Would the corporate image of their respective sponsors be damaged? Would the shareholders rise up in their wrath and complain? Would anything happen? Other than a few million people would have received a little illumination on subjects that may well determine the future of this country and therefore the future of the corporations. To those who say people wouldn't look, they wouldn't be interested, they're too complacent, indifferent, and insulated, I can only reply, there is, in one reporter's opinion, considerable evidence against that contention. But even if they are right, what have they got to lose? Because if they are right, and this instrument is good for nothing but to entertain, amuse, and insulate, then the tube is flickering now, and we will soon see that the whole struggle is lost. This instrument can teach, It can illuminate, and yes, it can even inspire. But it can do so only to the extent that humans are determined to use it towards those ends.
So just to back up a little bit, there was a time in our history when people were terrified about the idea that communists had infiltrated our American government. Part of that came from the fact that communism was on the rise in the Soviet Union. America was engaged in the Cold War with the Soviets. And we weren't quite at the point of the Vietnam conflict, but it was coming. There was the idea that if we don't stand up for democracy abroad, there's going to be a domino effect and the whole world will fall to communism. So with that fear very present in people's minds, a young junior senator came along named Joseph McCarthy and proceeded to identify and purge all suspected communists from the United States government. So then comes along Edward R. Murrow, a guy who was in charge of a show or was the anchor of a show called See It Now on CBS. Murrow decided, you know, nobody's really taking on this guy and exposing what he's saying. We need to take it upon ourselves. And what starts out as a small news story about a guy named Milo Radulovich, who was kicked out of the Air Force for having supposed communist sympathies, suddenly balloons into a greater conflict between Murrow and McCarthy. And there's a great scene in the movie where George Clooney, who plays Fred Friendly, the producer, has a meeting with two colonels who basically come in and say, look, you can't run this piece. We haven't had a chance to approve it yet. And then this will be the part where George Clooney's having a fight with them and saying, you know, who's seen this evidence? So what's interesting about this scene is we have this dynamic of the one guy who's basically saying, look, you're not here to approve the piece. You're here to give the other side to it.
Fairness doctrine.
Exactly. And what's even cooler, we don't have it the clip here for this show, but earlier in the movie, Murrow says to one of the powers that be, look, the other side has been represented quite enough over the past couple of years. It's time to show the other side of it.
So just a couple of production notes. George Clooney directed this movie. And one of my favorite things about this movie is how Clooney humbles himself. He humbles his character. The clip that we just played is one of the few times you actually really see Fred Friendly's face. Clooney is constantly obscuring himself. He puts himself in the background. He'll blur his face, or if he does have a close-up of his face, someone will walk in front of him. And this, A, goes against George Clooney's public image that we all know him to be kind of smug but and arrogant, but in a likable way. And B, it really works for his character because he's the man behind the scenes. He's just there to take on the burdens but let Murrow be the voice to America. There's a lot that I love about this movie. Robert Downey Jr. is in it, along with Patricia Clarkson.
Anthony Langella is in it.
Yes, yes. And they have...
Not Anthony, Frank Langella. Frank yes. Langella plays the head of the station, Mr. Paley.
Yes.
And Jeff Daniels is in it as well.
Jeff Daniels is in it. He likes to go into these roles. There's like an adorable subplot between Clarkson and Downey Jr. where they're a married couple, but they can't let anyone at the station know that they're married.
Because they had a rule against married couples working in the same department.
Which just adds a little bit of levity to this, like, very heavy-handed story. Also, quick note on McCarthyism. After working through the government, Joseph McCarthy then turned his sights on Hollywood. And we might talk about The Blacklist in a future episode. But his next goal was to take out all of the subversives and the communist messaging that he thought happened in Hollywood. And so even then, we were very aware of how pop culture and how media can affect and impact and change a person's judgment. Even if they do not have direct communist sympathies, it's possible that they may get them from the movies.
And what's kind of a shame is despite all the good that Murrow and his team did, I mean, their actions directly influenced the Senate's decision to censure McCarthy and say, you've overstepped your bounds, you've ruined people's lives, and you've invested, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money in these crusades and, you know, we're not rid of the people and it's unnecessary. He exploited the fears. But the sad footnote in history is that Murrow was kind of bumped from the thing he really wanted to do and relegated to the role of being an entertainment reporter, interviewing people like Liberace and Zsa Zsa Gabor and all these other people.
And we see this in the movie.
Yeah, we do. We see that he's like, oh God, I have to, you know, pay the piper and I have to do this bit where I talk to an entertainment person, even though the thing I really want to do is talk about news that's happening in the world. So he kind of got taken down a peg for doing the right thing. And something I tell my 12-year-old nephew all the time, the thing that seems like it's the best course of action or the quote-unquote right, honorable thing to do can sometimes be the hardest and actually cost you more than it would be if you did nothing.
I think it's very interesting to compare the speech that we just heard from Edward R. Murrow in Good Night and Good Luck, which takes place in the... That speech happens in the late 60s, to 10 years later, what Howard Beale is saying about television being an illusion, being bullshit in network. Just such a stark contrast between this box can inform and this box can entertain. Both of those, I think, exist at the same time. They blur the lines. That's what puts us in Rainbow Land. Is this box telling us things? Then this can be the television or your phone
or the
your,
internet.
The internet.
The internet is the new television.
It can inform. It can also distort. Is there room for Edward R. Murrow and Howard Beale? Maybe. I don't know. So what have we learned, Marta?
We've learned that Macedonia is slowly but surely taking over the world.
Well, maybe, maybe not. Like, nobody who shared those stories was going to vote Hillary anyway.
This is true.
Like, that's... But we do need to be better at figuring out what our sources are, and we need to be smarter about our media consumption. Just like you may tell a child that what he sees on TV isn't necessarily real, not everything you read is real.
Mm-hmm.
And even the things that are real aren't that real. They've gone through multiple filters.
Right. We have to stop treating things like they were written by, you know, 8-year-old, you know, Cam Brady on Campaign. And we have to stop believing in this idea of Rainbow Land that doesn't exist. And we really have to start looking past the musings of a kid in Macedonia and realize this isn't real news. There are no primary sources. And we have to really come to terms with what is reality and how far are we willing to go in order to get there.
That being said, it's not just the kids in Macedonia. We have to look at who's printing the news that's happening here. Mm-hmm. Like, where are those sources coming from? I don't know where to go from there.
Maybe that's it. We began with a question and we ended with a question.
Yeah, so...
So, until next time.
I guess if we're going to wrap us up, we'll put links to IMDb pages for all the movies we've talked about today. Thank you for listening to Political Theater. Sorry we didn't explain what reality was.
Until next time, this is Marta Russick.
I'm Martin R. Schneider. Thank you for listening to Political Theater.
See you in Rainbow Land.
Oh my God, her name is Ida. She's literally the Ides of March.
Dun, dun, dun.
That just hit me.